Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. You can follow me and the show on Twitter at FTCNHost. Thanks for listening. In this episode of From the Crow's Nest, we return for part two of my conversation with the distinguished team from Draper on microelectronics supply chain. Part one of our conversation was released on January 18th. We focused a lot on some of the big picture concepts and important policy developments, and in this episode, we look more closely at technology innovation from a technical perspective. I'm again joined by Jen Santos, Chief Corporate Strategic Initiatives Office at Draper, Laboratory Fellow Jeremy Freifeld, and Program Manager David Hegerstrom. You can learn more about them by visiting our show notes, and you can learn more about Draper, an independent nonprofit engineering innovation company, at draper.com. Without further delay, let's return to my conversation with Jen, Jeremy, and David from Draper. In this episode, we want to dive more into the solution. What's, from a technology perspective, what's going on today? Where are we going in the evolution that is taking place here? And so I wanted to start off, and maybe David might be the right person to start off with. But one, for our listeners, this is obviously a very complex issue. Could we kind of provide a lay of the land of who are the major players and kind of where technology is right now in terms of what the capacities of these players are producing?
Well, thanks, Ken. Let me start to answer the question a little bit tangentially. I think if you can visualize an electronics board, a circuit board, the green widget that's in just about anything in your pocket these days, you can think of it in terms of four kinds of work that goes into that. One is a very integrated set of process steps, usually thousands of process steps, manufacturing steps, that goes into the silicon itself. And most of the state-of-the-art silicon, the computer chips that we revolve our lives around come from offshore nowadays. But that kind of manufacturing is very distinct. It's very highly integrated. It's very expensive. And then what happens with that wafer, that silicon wafer, it gets cut up, sometimes with a laser, sometimes with a diamond saw. It gets cut up into individual chips. And those individual chips get assembled in some combination to make what I would call a module. That's called packaging. And you'll hear a lot about heterogeneous integration or advanced packaging. That means taking those individual silicon chips and assembling them. Now, there's a couple things that go into that as well, besides just assembly machines. The substrate that they're all put together on is in itself a complex, integrated product. And the substrate and then the circuit board that ultimately brings the system together, those are both very integrated processes. The United States used to dominate those fields, and we've lost about 80% of the market share, probably more, to Asian manufacturers. And then the final assembly of the individual modules onto the ultimate host circuit board is kind of an assembly step. I think in both of those assembly areas, we are in pretty good standing, or at least we have the potential to be very competitive through, I would say, modest types of investment in pieces of machinery, in plants. But the two very integrated processes, the silicon manufacture and the circuit board and substrate manufacture, we have lost a great deal of leadership in those, and it's hard to get back. It's a substantial investment to get those back. And I think those are areas that that need particular focus as we go forward.
And as far as the silicon itself, I mean, there's very few enterprises that can produce the state of the art. And when I say state of the art, I'm talking, you know, anything, I guess, below 5-7 nanometer these days. So there's really only two. There's TSMC, which is in Taiwan, and there's Samsung in South Korea. Intel is currently trying to play there onshore or offshore in Ireland and Israel, but they're not quite there yet. They don't have the same advanced technology that the other companies do. And so those that, you know, other than that, domestically, we also have Global Foundries, which as of last year is now a publicly traded company. Most of their manufacturing facilities are in upstate New York. Those manufacturing facilities were actually built by the government. And Global Foundries has a long history back to AMD and other things, but they're still at around the, you know, the 12 nanometer type node at the low. So they're several generations behind state of the art. I would say Intel right now is, you know, 2 to 3 generations behind, and Global Foundries is even more like, you know, 4 or 5 generations behind state of the art offshore manufacturing.
So when we talk about the supply chain, there are a number of companies globally, and a few of them do certain things really well, and then others do other things really well. And you mentioned the difference between, you know, component manufacturing and assembly and so forth. And if you're trying to strengthen your supply chain, you can't do it in a vacuum. So if you're trying to do something, obviously you have competitors globally that are trying to also keep their share of the market. So from, you know, where we're at today, what would you say US does the best at in terms of our position in the market?
So the two things the US is really great at still today, one is design and electronic design automation tools, which are the software that we use to do the large chip designs. So I don't remember the exact statistics, but approximately 80% of electronic design is still done onshore. And that's largely to do to the fact that we have 90% of the electronic design automation market. So the U.S. is really one of the only countries that can integrate one of these 30 billion transistor chips into a cohesive component from a design perspective. And then second is industrial tooling. We share a very strong industrial tooling capability with Japan and the Netherlands.
Sorry, what is industrial tooling?
So there's end item manufacturers, like I mentioned, TSMC and Samsung. They produce the silicon chips, but the machines which they use to produce them are not sourced locally to South Korea or Taiwan at all. They have very little industrial tooling capability. So the tooling that they use is purchased from the US, Japan, and the Netherlands. And so we're very strong in that market still.
So let me just step back just for a second. When you think of supply chain, right, you often think of someone that builds a car and then it's got all the suppliers, or builds a truck and builds all the suppliers. When you think of a microelectronic, it is from design through multiple steps till you have a product. So if you think of that as the supply chain, I think that will, if you can visualize what I mean by that, right? So, and I don't have that. We have a really great slide that describes the steps and actually to the end product. But you think of each one of those steps has industry partners that design, that do those phases of creation. So the design side of it, Draper Designs, you guys can talk about all the different companies that design, are exquisite designers of these chips, but there's a whole bunch of them, right? And so now you have a strong industrial base. It's not just a single supplier that does design. And then you go to the next step and you look at the creator or the industry partners. When you get to the middle part of it, which is the foundries and the manufacturing, Jeremy, you want to talk about that? So now you can see how it maps.
That's where you're constrained to those couple of manufacturers today at the state-of-the-art nodes. So, you know, the U.S. has a very good capability for design. A lot of designers, NVIDIA, AMD, most of those chips are designed in the U.S. and then to be manufactured, they're sent over to foreign companies for manufacturing. Packaging, they're sent over to even different countries like Singapore and Malaysia for advanced packaging, although, you know, Taiwan and South Korea are investing in that area as well. And then they're sent primarily to China for circuit board assembly, and then they come back to the U.S. for integration or sales, really. So that's about where we stand right now from a state-of-the-art supply chain.
So is the manufacturing creating a bottleneck in the supply chain process?
Yes, and as you think of it as a line, right, literally each step, phase 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 12, there's 12 that we have. Each one of those, there's, 50 companies in the first phase, 2 companies in the second stage. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But when you get to manufacturing, that's why the CHIPS Act is important, because the CHIPS Act is focused on manufacturing. So the middle part, it's not on the design. So the design houses, although are important, we got to keep an eye that they don't go offshore, because there's no capital investment into them, right? Right. And so this investment from the government into the industrial base to shore up some of those vulnerabilities is really focused towards the middle part of the development phase.
Yeah, and that is the bottleneck, and that's where we have the problem, because having 2, even 3 companies being able to produce the entire world's state-of-the-art chips is obviously an issue. We saw that during COVID. It's still hard to buy new cars nowadays because although they don't use state-of-the-art chips, but it's still hard to buy new cars nowadays because there's a limiter for chip supply, both at state-of-the-art nodes and at the state-of-the-practice nodes. And that limiter, for example, it gets sold. Back to the kind of the Spectrum thing, it gets sold. So, for example, Apple has bought the next 3 years production from TSMC at a certain node. So even if somebody else wanted to produce chips at that node, they could not, because Apple has already consumed the entire capability there.
Yeah, and I think it might be good for us to define what is legacy, present, and state-of-the-art, the 3 different sectors.
Sure. Sure. Well, right now, I would say state-of-the-art, this is obviously evolving. It used to be less than 10 nanometers. Now I would say it's about 7 nanometers or under for state-of-the-art, none of which is really produced onshore, although, Intel will debate a little bit about 7 nanometers itself, but none of which is produced offshore. Then there's kind of state-of-the-practice, which is that 12 nanometer node still in very high volume production, say 22 to 10 state-of-the-practice, where that exists in several different worldwide locations. And the plants are still running at capacity. And then there's legacy nodes, which for logic, for like computer chips is probably larger than 28 or so. Although I do want to point out, and this is part of the issue with Mathletronics, is the memories themselves, those are usually at legacy like type node sizes, which, 45 nanometer, 28 nanometer for flash. So those are kind of like the legacy products, which are typically into the kind of the more integrated products like cars. They would typically choose state of the practice or legacy. They wouldn't really be at state of the art. State of the art is like laptops, cell phones, graphic cards, gaming consoles type things.
And most of legacy chips are in national security issues, right? And so now you can start to see, right, if you're building a plane, a ship, a submarine, you're probably using legacy microelectronics, which gets back to a supply chain issue with not having suppliers available to continue to still build legacy microelectronics. The state of the art, which is the other extreme, which is the most sophisticated as well as faster, are typically in more commercial end items.
But we see that changing over the next 1 to 2 decades. That's very important that we start, integrating state-of-the-art components into weapon systems at a much faster rate. I have a little anecdote. I'll go off here. So DARPA had a program called Alpha Dogfight. I don't know if you've heard of this or saw this, but they basically pit AI pilots against human pilots in the same aircraft. And, this is an ongoing program. It's also DARPA ACE, A-C-E program. But in the first round of the battle scenarios, humans lost every round. And it wasn't due to, like, the AI fancy maneuvering or anything like that. The AI pilots flew straight at the human pilots and just locked on and shot them down before the human pilots could do anything. In the end, after, like, 5 battles, the human pilot started pulling up and doing all kinds of crazy maneuvers, but the AI pilot didn't really do much, just kind of continued to point his nose at him, acquired the target, and shot it. And what's going to happen pretty soon, especially with the autonomous things, autonomous vehicles, whether they're underwater, whether they're land-based, whether they're air-based, space-based, what's going to happen pretty soon, and we see this in Ukraine today, is that you're going to have two drones flying at each other to deliver weapons. And the drone with the more powerful processor is going to win. There's not going to be any luck. There's not going to be any skill. It's whoever has the more dense amount of gates operating at the higher clock frequency will acquire the target and shoot it down first. So that's it. And so if we don't have access to state of the art, but our adversaries do, we lose. There's no fancy math to it. It's just
We lose. And that's a great point.
What do we have in place today that points that we're going in the right direction on this?
I mean, right now, you know, a good bulk of our weapon systems have humans in the loop. Like our most advanced drones, like Predators, have humans on the ground with Xbox controllers doing a lot of the target acquisition and ordnance deployment, right? There are always humans in the kill chain currently. But you see that very slowly eroding to where there's more autonomy in the kill chain. And I think that that's where the danger becomes, that we're really, really going to lose out. And even if we don't do it, even if we don't automate our kill chain, our adversaries will. Mm-hmm. And the computer will be faster than the human every time.
Yeah, and I'll say this a little bit differently, all right? So from an acquisition perspective, the government buys things from industry, right? Plain and simple. They need a plane, a ship, or a sub, right? I'll just keep using those. They go ask industry, can you go build me a plane, a ship, or a sub, and put whatever technology is in it. Now, you probably are very aware that a lot of our weapon systems are old, right? And so the old weapon systems, to go put in a state-of-the-art microelectronic chip into an old weapon system means they have to do a spiral development, and it's many, many years away, right? And is it even a requirement? Do the requirers that build the plane, the ship, or the sub say, I need the latest state-of-the-art microelectronic in my weapon systems? No, because they don't buy microelectronics. They buy weapon systems. And so part of the change in this conversation, and this kind of goes back to the last conversation we just had, is educating our industry, executive, legislative branch on the value and importance of this so that they're better decision makers or driving where the technology is going. Because it's much easier to just stay with the processor that you have in your weapon system. It's much easier. And then we'll put on a new EW capability. We'll put on a new radar. We'll put on a new engine. But we're not going to go change out the guts, the brains that drive that mm-hmm. speed. And so as you design new capabilities, if you design and say, I need state-of-the-art, which some weapon systems are absolutely going to, but you have this whole history of, you know, we launch and we leave. We build a submarine. It, you know, you 5 years later do modernization to it. So, go ahead, Jeremy.
So a good analogy for this, what we're talking about, and I don't remember the current name, is the Phalanx capability that we deploy on ships, right? They switch them on. Those are totally autonomous. If something's flying or cruising towards them, they can take it out. But maybe a little bit. But the bullet technology has not improved that much. But what the Navy keeps doing is upgrading the internal guts of the Phalanx. Has a lot less, sensor dead zones and a lot faster acquisition and time on target. And I think that that's the way that warfighting is just going to happen in general as the 21st century gets rolling. So if we don't keep pace, we're going to be left behind.
Or you even look at that with critical infrastructure, mm-hmm. right? Critical infrastructure in this country is sitting on old legacy nodes, right? It's not at the state of the art. And so... similar, you know, bringing together all the powers of the executive branch to say, all right, we're going to go together and we're going to grow together and drive those capabilities, encouraging industry to invest, right? So if TSMC and Samsung are the two leaders, as Jeremy said, we want to have two or three in the United States as well. You're going to have driving that capability to that same level. So industry will invest and then come to the table.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Cole Morgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry.
What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users on a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompany lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Battelle team. And now it's time to get back to our show.
So in our last episode, we talked a lot about, you know, the aggregation of demand. And, you know, we're talking about the bottleneck in manufacturing. And, of course, then you have the legacy to more advanced technology. There's a lot to address, but I'm trying to get what I want to get talk about a little bit, I guess, is just the issue of capacity. How you know, whenever you can talk about build, you know, new chips for new advanced weapon systems or evolution of capability, but how can you affect the capacity or the sheer number of what you need to buy to convince industry that, yeah, this is where we need to be going? I mean, or is that not, how does that play into this? Because it seems like if you're trying to move from legacy to advanced, you're only talking relatively a small piece of the market.
So again, I'll kind of go back to what I said about four areas of electronics manufacturing. Because when you're talking about capacity, you're talking about capacity to manufacture these things, right? So you have to build the silicon, and that's very expensive. The way state-of-the-art silicon is made today, it's on a very high volume basis. You need about $10 billion to set up a factory, and then it has to operate, or more, and it has to operate nearly 24/7 to get a return on investment. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem area. The other three that I mentioned, the sort of the assembly of those chips into a package, the building of the circuit boards, and the final assembly of circuit boards, they actually scale very nicely. You can put a plant in place for any one of those operations for much orders of magnitude less money, and it can be right-sized for the kind of demand we see from the DOD or from the government. So I think there's ways to go after those three, although it still needs attention, but it's not healthy today. But I think there's ways to go after those three, and the silicon is a challenge.
So can you talk a little bit about that? Because you've reached the limit of my knowledge a while ago, but I mean, I talk a little bit about what goes into this, the production of silicon.
Oh, certainly. So there's a lot of processes, but you can think of them as kind of like layers or steps. So you start with a plain silicon wafer, and then you either add or subtract material to it. You dope it, so you put other things besides silicon within the silicon itself in order to change its electrical properties.
So what types of substance would you be using for that?
Oh, for doping? I mean, usually like you can think of like noble gas type thing, like boron. We do fluoride, boron, but we also, in the really state-of-the-art advanced nodes, we start doping with 3-5 type materials, which are gallium arsenide, gallium nitride, silicon carbide. There's a lot of different materials. So it's a very, very complex standpoint. I say this to my colleagues a lot, but it is the most complicated human endeavor yet realized. So it is the most complex engineering feat that humans have been able to do is to produce these state-of-the-art microelectronics. And the production of them is in the highest, tightest controlled environment known to man. So the foundries themselves, one of the reasons they're so expensive, not only because of the tooling that we put into them, but also the environment they're manufactured is the most tightly controlled environment that mankind has yet created. So from just a pure engineering perspective, it is the pinnacle of human engineering to date. We can talk about moon landings, which I'm a very big fan of, Draper. We helped, not me, but my predecessors helped develop the Apollo guidance computer and that was huge of the day. But today, the moon landing type engineering is happening in the silicon foundries themselves.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that is the sophistication of this, mm-hmm. right? It's not just the supply chain and the industry partners that do it. It's those investments into those industry partners to be able to maintain those qualification standards mm-hmm. To be able to produce.
So you mentioned gallium arsenide, and gallium nitride, and use of production of the silicon.
So nowadays, what we think of as a transistor, which is the base building block for complementary metal oxide semiconductor, CMOS, it used to be just all silicon with some different noble implantation to change the transconductance of the silicon itself. But nowadays, David said before, there's thousands of steps, and each of those steps is adding or subtracting something to that silicon. And a lot of that is like new material technology and different things. Like we still think of copper, you know, especially in the defense industrial base, as kind of a gold standard for conducting for passing signals. But at the very deep submicron state-of-the-art foundries, they're like replacing copper with, you know, different like cobalt and zirconium and stuff like that at this point. So it's very advanced engineering and material science stuff that goes into the, you know, all of a lot of the people that get physics degree that used to go into like particle physics and things like that are now really working on kind of the microelectronic fabrication problems.
You know, we've had this conversations in the past at AOC about, you know, the resource availability, you know, mining of rare earth elements and so forth, and the availability of the materials that go into this, and the limited supply that we have there to even start this whole thousands of step process. You know, what is the next? Is there a next step where we're not as resource constrained in the materials that we're using?
So there's a published roadmap, but I don't think it really addresses kind of the raw material supply issue. I mean, the public roadmap is really focused on continuing to scale the transistor to allow higher transistor density for state-of-the-art applications. But I'm going to flip that on you and say an issue is that the manufacturing today, even at TSMC's perspective, you know, the question is it economically sustainable? And that's the real question. So at the 7-nanometer node, we did a calculation, 80% of the cost at the 7-nanometer, which is kind of one or two generations ago in the iPhone, 80% of that cost is equipment depreciation and maintenance. And as Dave mentioned, he said $10 billion. I would argue that, you know, at the 3-nanometer, we're talking a $30 billion startup cost for a foundry. You have to have such a large market share before you build the foundry captured in order to make that foundry sustainable that it's really not economically viable to stand up true competitors in the state-of-the-art space with the current manufacturing paradigm. That's the fundamental mm-hmm. problem that we have. And, you know, the CHIPS Act really needs to understand that people in the advisory board and the Commerce Department need to understand that, you know, it's not going to get a good return on investment if we're just doing like for like. And that's where we talk about at Draper a kind of domestic differentiation. And I think that the thing that we are trying to educate the various policymakers on is that the way forward is probably to not at the end item manufacturer like the Intel, TSMC, or Samsung type thing, but at the industrial tooling and design phase to try to change the manufacturing paradigm to allow a lower cost of entry and a higher speed of technology development. So right now, TSMC, to build a new plant in Arizona, you know, it's going to take them 3 years just to get the first product off of the thing. And you know, that's fine from a commercial perspective because they have their roadmap, they know what they're doing. But if we want to overtake foreign advances in technology, we have to iterate faster than them. And so we're going to have to do it with a different paradigm, with a new industrial tooling in order to realize what we call low volume, high mix, which means we can use the same or similar tool sets to develop legacy components for, you know, older weapon systems and use those tools to realize the highest technology implementations as well.
Yeah, and what we call, the way Jeremy did a really good job describing that, we call that being disruptive, mm-hmm. right? You have to disrupt that early phase and think differently and operate differently to expect a different outcome. You know, using the same materials, the same tooling, the same design to beat a competitor isn't the answer here.
That already has a pretty substantial lead on you.
Yes. So the disruption has to begin at the early part of this development process.
So David, you know, from looking at the evolution of the chip, you know, obviously, there's this concept of Moore's law, and it's, you know, getting smaller, an order of magnitude smaller. Where is the evolution of the chip taking us, and what are some of the advances that are, you know, both most exciting to you, or maybe developments that are maybe keeping you awake at night, thinking like, here's where chip technology is going. Here's where we need to be. Kind of here's the point in the future we need to be meeting it at.
Yeah. So. I would say you can think of it in two paths. One path is heterogeneous integration. In other words, there's a lot of products that combine a lot of functions into a microelectronic module, and those functions don't all need to be built at the state of the art. Memory, depending on what the product is, you might be able to do just fine with memory that's built from a different semiconductor node. So there's a great deal of attention going into heterogeneous integration, and that's really coupled with the idea of advanced packaging. How do you assemble these heterogeneous pieces of silicon into a very efficient, very high performance combination in the package? So that's one direction. That's very exciting. It's getting a lot of attention, and it's one where we are playing some catch up here in terms of, or we need to play catch up in order to be competitive. And the other is at the silicon or semiconductor level. You know, Moore's law has been, talked about for many, many years. It seems like there's still some life in Moore's law with three-dimensional processing and some of the other innovations that we need to pay attention to.
Certainly, and the government and in government, basically DARPA and industry is very focused on the next what. There's carbon nanosheets, what we call gate all around structures. So it's really the as our computational physics become more advanced because of the new computers, we can develop more advanced structures with which to manufacture. And then we develop new tooling with which to manufacture those structures. And what we're saying is we need to just flip that a little bit and go to the how and focus a little bit first on the tooling to make the tooling economically viable from a high mix, low volume application so that we can swap tooling out and achieve technology more quickly.
Now, part of that paradigm might be simply having a branch, and simply is obviously a misnomer, but having a branch in the equipment business model, which allows for a smaller scale copy of the same thing that's being built for the big commercial companies. If you're putting a 300 millimeter, a large piece of equipment in the market in order to support the high volume business, might there not be a market for a scaled down version of that that would be, it would benefit from the R&D that's done for the commercial unit and be much more affordable?
Okay. Well, right, so the industrial tooling, you know, kind of make these pilot tools themselves, but they usually don't make them commercially available because of the economics of development. And I think that, you know, where we would steer kind of the policymakers is kind of to directly investing into the tooling itself so that we can gain access to those early pilot tools in order to construct new manufacturing processes.
Yeah. We talked about partnerships, industry, government. You know, obviously, there's the nonprofit world and associations like the AOC. What role do you see associations like the AOC playing in terms of encouraging these partnerships, but especially in the STEM world, in interacting with colleges and universities and engineering programs? What can we do to kind of help this along from a private nonprofit perspective?
So I'll say Association of Old Crows has been around for how long?
About 60 years.
Yeah. And so you have an opportunity to educate. I mean, you have brilliant folks associated with this association that are high tech, understand electronic warfare, right? Electronic components. You have this opportunity to educate, bringing, you know, hosting these type of sessions and then sharing this with the younger workforce, not just with the association, bringing this to light in a way that's spoken in, I joke and say it's in English and not in government speak, right? Having the English kind of conversation around this and not the government speak, I think can bring a lot to light. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll kind of reiterate my 1,000 points of light. My granddaughter is doing Lego robotics, and it's just a great thing, and it's a very local grassroots kind of thing with, she's in a girls program after school. It's all girls learning robotics, and any one of your members, anyone really listening to this podcast could think about, you know, can I reach out at that local level and start to incite the young children to have an interest in a field like this?
Yeah, because they grew up with laptops at their fingertips, right? I mean, my kids, as soon as they could figure, I actually had my son take computer classes before I had him work on his handwriting. Truthful, I said, you can type way faster than you can write things and you'll use that. So making, you know, they are learning, but the knowledge and skills that you have that can transfer to those folks, I mean, robotics classes, yes, there are so many opportunities in those spaces to educate the future of our national and economic security.
So we're running out of time here. So Jen, any closing thoughts in terms of wrapping everything up that we were discussing, or any points that we did not get to?
So I'll tell you that, one, it's really a pleasure for us to hopefully bring education, insight, and intellect to a problem that our company spends a lot of time investing in. I mean, over a third of our engineers work distinctly on the microelectronics problem from a safety and security issue. And so giving us that opportunity is fantastic. And hopefully we brought some education to your listeners. But we need to challenge ourselves, industry, executive branch, legislative, to address the questions we've been just discussing. We need to partner with friends and allies to amplify our collective competitive advantages. We need to instill a sense of responsibility to the national and economic security problem, because rapid changes in technology shapes every aspect of our lives and national interests. We must reinvest in retaining our scientific and technological edge, working alongside our partners to seize those opportunities and advance national security. Microelectronics is a perfect example of this. We need the United States emerging technology to boost our security and our economic competitiveness. We're honored to be able to bring this education to light in the vein that we have. And we look forward to continued conversations over the next years.
And I appreciate you taking time to join me here in person, having this conversation. As always, you know, we could always spend, you know, twice as much time talking about this, and hopefully this will be an opportunity where we can have you back and continue this conversation, not just with our podcast, but through our other programs that we have, whether it's webinars or conferences. You know, I think our community needs to hear from your expertise on a regular basis. So looking forward to that opportunity as well. But do thank you for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guests, Jen Santos, Jeremy Freifeld, and David Hagerstrom, for joining me here for our two-part conversation. Again, you can download part one, which was released on January 18th. And you can learn more about Draper via their website at draper.com. Also, don't forget to review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please take some time to let us know how we're doing. That's it for today. Again, you can follow me on Twitter at FTCNHost. Thanks for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.